Copper and Brass Incorporated. Founded by Paul Revere in 1801. Fabricators of copper, copper alloys, and aluminum alloys for home and industry. And makers of the famous Revereware presents Meet the Press.
Our guest of the afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, will be Ambassador Rahim, the Egyptian ambassador, whose country is now engaged in a critical struggle over control of the Suez Canal Zone.
But before we meet the press, let us turn back the pages of history and reflect for a few moments on those things which have helped shape the destiny of our United States of America. In the year 1769, Bostonians were greeted by such newspaper items as a letter written by John Wilkes from King's Bench Prison, where he was thrown for upholding the rights of the colonies. What was to be a 10-year business depression was gaining momentum. There was no longer a market for the fine silverware with which the famed goldsmith Paul Revere had been supplying wealthy Bostonians. So the enterprising Paul Revere had, among other things, turned his talents to the more lucrative pursuit of the manufacture of false teeth. To procure customers, he had placed an advertisement in the Boston Gazette to inform those who had lost their four teeth by accident and other ways that they may have them replaced with false ones that looked as well as the natural. To obtain a true picture of the amount of talent and versatility possessed by Paul Revere, one must journey to the Massachusetts Historical Society, Boston, and delve into his writings and correspondence. You will find his personal account of his famed midnight ride, as well as poems that compare favorably with the works of the leading poets of the day. There also is a request by the colonial government to plan two mills for the manufacture of gunpowder. Records also show that during the waning days of the Revolution and after the war, he cast cannon from iron and brass. He was also a caster of bells. During the period before the war, while he was busy being a patriot and courier, Paul Revere still found time to turn out huge quantities of copper plate engravings, including the designs of the colony's seal and the plates for printing the colony's paper money. Many of his engravings were of a political nature, such as this one. The most famous one, however, being that of the Boston Massacre of March 5, 1770. Circulated throughout the colonies, it inflamed public opinion to fever heat, and "no taxation without representation" became the slogan of the day. Revere's political cartoons did much to hasten the final break with England. It was this same Revere, the maker of false teeth, the caster of cannon and bells, poet, silversmith, midnight rider, and patriot, who in 1801 turned his talents to rolling copper sheets and founded the first successful copper rolling mill in America. That was the beginning of the company known today as Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated, oldest independent fabricator of copper and copper-based alloys in the nation. Also fabricators of aluminum alloys, electric welded steel tube, and the famous Revereware.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, meet the press. America's press conference of the air. Ready for this afternoon's unrehearsed spontaneous press conference are four of America's top reporters. Please remember that their questions do not necessarily reveal their point of view. It's their way of getting a story for you. But first, here is the moderator of Meet the Press.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another session of Meet the Press. Seated around the press table this afternoon, we have Mr. John O'Donnell of the New York Daily News, Mr. John Henry of the Washington Star, Mr. John Hightower of the Associated Press, and Mr. Lawrence Spivak of Mercury Publications and a regular member of our press panel. Now, Ambassador Rahim, if you are ready, I think we will let Mr. Hightower have the first question.
Mr. Ambassador, are Egypt and Iran, as countries having current difficulties with Britain, trying to form an anti-British bloc in the Middle East?
I do not believe, Mr. Hightower, that we are trying to form any anti-bloc whatsoever. You know, Iran and Egypt are the Muslim countries, have been tied through the whole period of history with very strong ties, not only Iran, but Pakistan, Indonesia, and all this Muslim world, they always tied with links of history, the links of being people of the Near East, the links of having also their own problems which are practically similar. But I do not believe that there is any anti-blocks. They follow their own genuine policy.
Mr. Henry.
Mr. Ambassador, do you expect anything in the nature of an all-out or conventional type of war between Britain and Egypt as a result of this trouble?
Well, I do not think, Mr. Henry, there will be a real war, but there is a shooting war now going on. There is violence. There is certain atrocities committed by the British troops on Egyptian civilians. But the Egyptian army, thanks to the violation of the British of the 1936 treaty, they didn't give us enough equipment, and our army is not equipped to fight the British. We are only relying on our justice, relying on our right, and relying on our passive resistance.
Well, by what means short of war do you expect your wishes in this matter to come about?
Well, by our force of right, by the force of justice, by the force of our passive resistance, and by the fact that the Suez Canal will never be defended without the cooperation of Egypt.
Mr. O'Donnell.
Mr. Ambassador, in the event that Egypt was successful, either through force of arms or passive resistance, in getting the British away from the canal, would you have the strength to defend it against a foreign force, such as Russia, if they should move in? Would it not create a vacuum in which the bigger power would normally rush in?
Well, this question of vacuum was a sort of a smokescreen which had made the people believe that there is a real vacuum. If the Egyptian army is well equipped, if the Egyptian army is armed, they are ready to defend with their own 100,000 soldiers now. They are ready also to raise to 1 million soldiers, ready also to pay for their own equipment, to defend their own selves, and to defend the world.
Did that answer your question, Mr. Donald?
Yes, I was merely had, to date, you point to the inability to secure arms, the present weakness. As a result, I understood, of the British failure to live up to an agreement to supply you. Well, now, that would take how many years to build up an effective army there, do you think?
Well, our army is
strong enough.
Yes, our army, as I told you, is now numbers from 80,000 to 100,000. They are trained on modern equipment, but they haven't got the equipment.
No, they're trained.
They are ready. Yes, they are ready. Once this equipment comes in, they are ready to use it, and in a short time, they are ready to defend their land.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Ambassador, the Egyptians were unable to handle the Israelis, who had a population of 1.5 million. How do you expect to handle the Russians?
Well, Mr. Spivak, this is a misconception which gained ground here in this country. As a matter of fact, between the Egyptian army and the Arab armies and Israel, there was no real war. The war was a sort of intermittent war, began a week, and then the Egyptian army and the Arab armies abided by the resolution of the United Nations to cease fire, and they ceased fire. Then after that, hostilities broke, and after the hostilities, then in a week's time or 2 weeks' time, this has been stopped. So really there was no war. If there was a real war, and if there was a battle, could you tell me on what battle the Egyptian army and the Arab armies have been defeated? Can they tell us what the number of the Egyptian troops has been prisoner? How many have been killed and wounded? For my own statistics and official statistics, I can tell you the Egyptian army didn't suffer more than 0.5% of its number between wounded and killed.
Well, You were killing people in the Israeli army, and they were killing you. I mean, we consider that something of a war, Mr. Ambassador.
Well, that was a war, but it has no result whatsoever because the war itself was not conclusive. Well, there was no battles.
Why did the Egyptian army stop if it was able to? Certainly, if you had been able to beat the Israeli, you'd have continued, wouldn't you?
We stopped because we abided by the United Nations and we accepted the ceasefire. We accepted the armistice because we are peaceful people.
Would you be willing to abide by the United Nations now on Suez?
We have been abiding by the United Nations resolutions all the time.
Would you
And the other party, I think, you should ask them this question, if they have abided by the internationalization of Jerusalem, if they have abided also by the resolution concerning the million refugees who are squandered all over the desert.
Mr. Ambassador, I'd like to come to the whole question of abrogating this treaty of 1936. Your prime minister, Nahas Pasha, claimed that the treaty, when it was signed in 1936, was signed by Egypt under duress. Was that true? Was it signed under duress?
Well, I think I could easily quote to you the words of Mr. Bevan personally about this question. I have them here. Mr. Bevan said on the Iranian question, when the Russians have invaded Azerbaijan and they wanted to take them out, the British government would regret any arrangement which might appear to have been extracted from the government of Iran by compulsion while Soviet government was still occupying a part of Iran. It was inadmissible to negotiate or attempt to negotiate or seek to obtain concessions from a smaller power in favor of a large power through the occupation of that country by armed force. And then Mr. Bevan also said, we are powerful. We are sometimes called the Big Three, and we are undoubtedly identified with power. Power has its weight in negotiations.
No, but Mr. Ambassador, I was talking about the Treaty of 1936. Was that signed, as your minister said, under duress?
That was signed while the country was occupied by the British troops, and the same occupation to which Mr. Bevan referred in the Iranian question,
well,
exactly
then,
the same condition.
How then do you explain what your prime minister, who was the same prime minister today, that was in power in 1936, said at that time at the signing of the treaty, and I quote him, we have of our full will and free will authorized the English to maintain a garrison on the canal. Now, does that sound like duress, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, it has at that time, we hoped that this treaty will be executed from both parties faithfully. We ourselves hope that by the end of this treaty, we will really be allowed to have our independence and have the power to protect our own homeland.
But hasn't the treaty 20 years to run, though?
It has 20 years to run, but it has been violated. Before it was abrogated, it has been violated and abrogated by the British before we did abrogate it. What we did is that we gave effect to an accomplished fact already made by the British.
What exactly did the British do, Mr. Ambassador?
Well,
they violated the treaty.
In
it had
many
been run
ways.
For many years, and then suddenly some action was taken to break it.
In many ways. First, they outstepped the territory designed for them for the occupation of their troops. They overstepped it. They kept more armies than the 10,000 that has been given. And more important than that, they had the obligation to train the Egyptian army in order that the Egyptian army would be capable to defend the Suez Canal. But 15 years have passed without giving the possibility for the Egyptian army to be equipped in order to play its part in defending.
Did you protest at any time?
All the time.
Along the way, or did you start your protest only when it seemed that the British Empire was breaking up?
No, sir. We have explored all avenues for negotiation and to come to an agreement since 1946. Immediately after the World War, we negotiated with the British, and then when we didn't succeed, and even the British in 1946 have accepted to withdraw their troops and initialed an agreement that they will remove their troops by September 1949.
Well,
and when we didn't succeed, then we presented our case to the United Nations, and the United Nations didn't. The question is still pending, and we continue with negotiation with them as late as September 1951.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, would your government be ready now to let the United Nations come to make the decision on this, and would your government abide by that decision if it were not in your favor? In other words, if the United Nations says that either an international group or the British themselves are to defend the Suez Canal zone, would your government be ready to accept that decision?
That the United Nations shall defend
the Suez Canal? If the United Nations says that either the British or an international group is to defend the canal zone, would your government be ready to accept that decision?
But if the United Nations would give such a decision, this decision will run counter to a treaty.
That wasn't the question, Mr. Ambassador.
To a treaty.
Would your government be ready to accept that decision?
Well, it depends. It depends if this question is submitted to the United Nations or not. I can't really answer if it is submitted. I can't really answer on a hypothetical basis.
In other words, you would accept a decision in your favor, but you would not accept a decision against you.
No, sir. We accept any decision that could be given, but now neither the British nor the Egyptians think of presenting the problem to the United Nations.
You are not answering my question, Mr. Ambassador. Do you think the Egyptian government would accept a decision on the part of the United Nations which said that the British troops were to remain in the Suez Canal zone, or that an international group of soldiers was to take care of the canal zone?
I do not think the United Nations have the right to give such a decision.
Then you would not accept that decision.
No. If the United Nations gives a decision to condone the continuation of foreign troops on the land of a sovereign power, it will be running counter to its own charter.
Oh, but your own government condoned that by the treaty you made in 1936.
Well, this treaty, as I told you, has certain circumstances which they didn't live to their own obligations, the British.
Mr. Hightower.
Mr. Ambassador, what was the specific reason given by your government for the denunciation of this treaty at the time the action was taken, I think, earlier this year? When Egypt denounced the treaty, yes. What was the specific reason given?
Well, the specific reason was that we have been negotiating with the British since 1946, immediately after the end of the war, and we have explored all avenues for agreement. We did our best to come to an agreement, as I told you, as late as 1951, but we didn't come to a certain result, and we found that the intention of the British is to keep their troops forever on our land. These troops have been there since 1882.
How much longer did the treaty have to run, sir?
I think about 5 years more.
Was there never any feeling that perhaps the contract could be kept if there could be more patience on both sides and the treaty would eventually run out?
Well, I really don't know if you ask for patience. We had patience now for 5 or 6 years. And when people looking for their own independence, clamoring for their rights, it is very difficult to stop the people. When your country in 1776 wanted to end the colonial policy of the British here, you couldn't stop the people. It is a national and a popular demand which no government could stop it.
Yes, sir. Well, is that the real issue in the case now, that there are such terrific popular pressures in Egypt behind the desire to get the British out that really no government could say, make a deal or an agreement with the British at this time which would be satisfactory to the British?
Well, the pressure on the government is a pressure always for the independence and for the realization of the God-given rights of the Egyptians.
What I had in mind, sir, was that, as I recall, after 3 years of negotiation, or perhaps two, around 1948 or 49, the two governments did reach a tentative agreement on a revision of the treaty, which then was rejected by the Egyptian parliament.
No, I can put right this fact. It wasn't rejected by the Egyptian parliament. That was in 1946. I was there, and there was party to these negotiations. Our prime minister and minister of foreign affairs went to London and initialed a treaty for the revision with the British. But the British find some way to do away with this initial treaty. If this treaty has been passed, the British troops would have been out of Egypt long since September 1949.
Mr. Henry.
Mr. Ambassador, as soon as this abrogation action was announced, the Russian ambassador in Cairo had conferences with your foreign minister. The Russians have indicated an approval of what you are doing. A few days ago, your delegation in the United Nations approved a certain position that the Russians had taken. Will you discuss your relations with Russia a little bit?
Well, our relations with Russia are the relations as all countries have with countries who are represented diplomatically. And our foreign minister declared that the relations with Egypt and Russia is governed by the United Nations Charter. Economically, if I can give you our balance sheet with Egypt and Russia, we have no commercial treaty. Simply, from time to time, we have certain barter deals of our cotton and our and their own wheat. Perhaps since 1946, we have two or three deals like that. But there is no commercial treaty. Added to that, if you just examine what the other part, the British had, they had a legalized treaty that they give them all strategic materials, including rubber. And if you study your congressional record, you have all sorts of statistics that show that Britain is dealing with the Soviet Union, with communist China, with very strategic materials. Up to now, we didn't recognize communist China.
I'm aware of that, but what I'm thinking of is there a possibility of some closer relationship, or in other words, a deal being made between Soviet Russia and the Arab nations, or Egypt specifically, as a result of this
deal? I personally know nothing of such deals.
What is the status of communism in Egypt?
Well, communism is not legalized in Egypt.
But there are communists.
There are communists and have been all the time driven underground. They don't call themselves communist parties. They call themselves committees of national liberation. But the latest aggression of the British have gave a possibility of these communist elements to rise. So in my opinion, the best way to help, to do away with this threat, is to disarm the communist elements of the colonial policy, which is still followed there in Egypt by the British.
Mr. O'Donnell.
Mr. Ambassador, reverting for a moment to this treaty of 36 and the question of violation thereof. Now, that under that treaty, it was agreed that Britain could maintain troops on the sovereign soil of Egypt for the defense of the canal. That was in 36. Now, am I correct? 10 years later, or after the end of the war, both the parties to that contract then signed another contract, to which is the Charter of the League of Nations, by which each agreed that the troops of a foreign country would not be installed on another sovereign state without its consent. Therefore, doesn't that second contract abrogate the first as a legal point?
You are quite right, Mr. O'Donnell. There is a resolution of the United Nations which says that no foreign troops will be allowed on a sovereign state without the permission of this state.
Yes.
So as a matter of fact, the presence of these British troops, it is against the United Nations Charter. Not only that, but also it is against a resolution which passed by the United Nations.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Ambassador, in a speech you made at Princeton in June, you said the enforced separation of the Sudan from Egypt is the cause of bitter resentment among the Egyptians and Sudanese alike. One of the issues is the question of the Sudan.
Yes.
Now, what do you mean by enforced separation? What makes you think the Sudanese would like to be under Egyptian rule?
Well, the Sudanese are the same religion, the same race, have been tied with Egypt through ages and ages of history. And moreover, they are tied with a relation which is more stronger than race and religion and language.
Well, according
they
to the
are,
information...
They are tied up with a Nile, which gives the life for both countries, and this is enforced because the British have followed a policy of separating Egypt from the Sudan.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, according to the information I have, the Sudanese are not Egyptians, and neither racially nor culturally.
Well, if they are not...
And there isn't any certainty that they want to join up with you. Now,
well,
is it logical, for example, for you to insist on breaking with the Egyptians,
well,
with the British at the very same time as you insist on taking over Sudanese?
Our Minister of Foreign Affairs, as late as last week, in his speech to the United Nations, he said that if the world thinks that the Sudanese do not want to unite with Egypt, I hereby declare that I am ready to give these people self-determination on a condition that this plebiscite will run according to the rules of the United Nations and under the auspices of the United Nations and in an atmosphere conducive to the liberty of expression, of freedom, self-determination.
Well, you are...
This challenge has been given in the United Nations in the highest rostrum in the world, and up to this time, the British didn't answer it.
Well, you are in favor, then, of having a plebiscite under the direction of the United Nations?
Certainly, we are in favor, but up to this moment, the British didn't answer it. The British have accused us that we want to colonize the Sudan, but as a matter of fact, we have proved to the world that we are sure that the Sudanese would like to unite with us because they are our brothers, have been always in history our brothers, and we told the world that we are ready to accept the self-determination.
Mr. Ambassador, I'd like to go to the Suez for another minute. Do you think that you are able to defend the Suez Canal in case of attack from the
Russians?
Can
you answer that yes or no, Mr. Ambassador?
I'm sorry,
I can't give you any more time. Our time is up. I hope we might have gotten an answer out of that one. This concludes the latest edition of Meet the Press. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for your willingness to meet the press. And now a word from our announcer.
Tune in next week at the same time when Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated will again present Meet the Press. Our guest will be another front page figure in the news. Now, good afternoon for Mr. John O'Donnell, Mr. John Henry, Mr. John Hightower, Mr. Lawrence Spivak, Miss Martha Rountree, Ambassador Rahim. You've met the press, now meet Revere Ware, that famous line of copper-clad stainless steel cooking utensils made by Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated.
Ah, kitchen magic.
You think that's magic? Just see what this Revere Ware double boiler with six lives can do. First, you see it as a double boiler. Now it becomes a mixing bowl. Now you see it used as an ice bowl. Now it's a saucepan. Or it can be used as a casserole, so sparkling and attractive that you can serve from it right at the table. And it's just the thing for storing food safely in the refrigerator. How's that for kitchen magic?
The double boiler is only one of a complete line of Revere copper-clad stainless steel cooking utensils. When hung on this Revere rack, they give your kitchen new sparkle and life. Join the happy millions of women who have brightened their kitchens, lightened their chores with Revere Ware. This trademark in the copper bottom identifies genuine Revere Ware. Insist on it.
Here's a special notice of interest to all Revere mill customers. It's no news to you that there's a shortage of brass mill scrap. But we've been through this kind of emergency before and know that when every American does his job, we come out on top. Once more, it's everybody's job to get in the scrap. The more brass mill scrap you divert back to our mills, the more new metal we can turn out for you. We'd appreciate it greatly if you'd send your brass mill scrap to us, or if more convenient, to your dealer today. Let's all get in the scrap. You'll be helping America and helping yourself. Meet the Press is originated and produced by Lawrence Spivak and Martha Rountree, directed by Carl Dagan, with L.A. McClelland as technical director, and brought to you each week by Revere Copper and Brass Incorporated. This is Tom Kennedy speaking.